Accession number 19990, reel 20.
Chief Technician Roper, reel 20. You were mentioning that Solito was going to be handed over to the Singapore Air Force. Had you known about these grand developments, about the decisions to run down the President's Easter Series and so on before they happened, or did it come as a surprise to you that we were...
No. We were forearmed about this, but for instance, a lot of the aircraft were scrapped. 30 Squadron, all its Beverleys, were broken down and sold off to the local Chinese manufacturers of pots and pans and things. And constantly from Salita, going down the road into central Singapore, were these little local lorries loaded up with aircraft wings and parts. They broke up the Javelins, they broke up the Belvederes, they broke up the Beverleys. And then it came our turn, and we left the single Pioneers. We gave them to RAF Tenga, who were operating Hunters, as these had supported them in a fighter control approach. And so a couple of the pilots were sent to Tenga, and the single Pioneers became part of 20 Squadron at Tenga. We had other single Pioneers up in Laos. That was a detachment from 209 Squadron on sort of air attaché jobs. We had one at one time in Saigon. The Laos mission one, it was up there. Well, I think two were wrecked in a storm. A tornado hit this airfield, Vientiane, and we lost, I think, two twin pioneers, single pioneers there. We had lost the odd one in northern Malaya. But once again, the twin pioneers, one or two were kept as sort of museum pieces, but I think the majority of them were scrapped. They were getting old and a lot of corrosion, and you couldn't get spares and so on. So we knew it was coming, and of course there were other units that were associated with the Far East Air Force. We had the hospital, which was a very big military hospital. We had the Joint Air Intelligence Reconnaissance Unit, or JARIC, which there are only two. There was one at Salita and there was one in Northolt in London. Marine craft units, everything started to run down. So it wasn't unexpected, but I mean, most of us were only interested in finishing our tour or getting home.
But these aircraft that were broken up, like the Beverleys and so on, mm-hmm. were they serviceable aircraft?
Oh, yes.
They could have been flown back to Britain and used.
Yes. But like most things, as something new comes in, they move the older aircraft overseas. And so the Hastings finished up in Singapore, the Beverley finished up in Singapore, the Belvedere. Now, of course, these were old hat. The spares were getting more difficult to find. They'd lost a percentage of them anyway, so they were sent out. And of course, it's good that because the weather was so fine in Singapore, a lot of aircraft behave themselves better. I mean, if you go to Singapore today, well, not today, but in my day, the cars in Singapore were things that had almost disappeared in the UK 10 years earlier, and they were still as new and running like clockwork. Austin, Cambridge, taxis and things like this, that they tend to keep things going for longer. And it happened to all the older aircraft, Valettas and so on. which were more or less written off from the UK's point of view and wouldn't be used in any active theatre in the future.
How did you get back to England then? What was the process for that?
Well, I had my wife and family with me, and so once again we moved into the Changi Creek Hotel for the last 24 hours, and I think I flew out from Pyalebe in a VC-10. I can't recall. I have flown from the Far East in a Britannia, but with my wife we were on a VC-10 as far as I remember, and we flew back into Brysnort. And then once again I was posted back to Odeham, and although it's an area that I like, it's a nice part of the country and it wasn't far from my parents' home, the work at Odeham tends to, it's helicopters, and usually it's helicopters operating in the middle of Salisbury Plain or going on this detachment or that detachment. But I was fortunate that I got the job as the NCO in charge of the engine bay because of my past experience at Changi, and also because I've been on helicopters and Gnome engines for some years. I was very fortunate in becoming the NCO in charge of the engine bay, and it was very rewarding work. It taught me a lot. The staff that I had, a number of corporals that had been there for some years and had helped develop the Gnome, were able to show me the finer points of it, and I was mainly the administrator anyway. I decided which engines would be repaired and which would be sent back to Rolls, as I say, it was just a case of keeping the four teams that I had busy servicing the Gnome engine, which was our prime duty. But we also had the odd engine from the Osters, and later we got the engine. We had the what they call the Puma. And Artust, I think it is, that it uses, they came through. But my prime job was servicing Gnome engines, and this was deep strip and rebuild.
Again, it sounds like you're, by this stage, you're really dealing more with management than with
yes.
hands-on servicing and mechanical
well,
work.
In that position, if there's something, a control to be checked, and any control linkage, flying control linkage or engine control linkage that's disturbed, needs a special oversignature or an independent control check. So you'd get one corporal would do the job and sign as having done it. Probably another corporal would sign as having checked the job that the corporal had done. And then they would raise, I would raise, an independent control check, and I would carry out the independent control check. And that would satisfy the system, but
it sounds though it's rather like auditing accounts in a way.
Yes,
the work's
yeah.
been done. You have to make sure it's been done properly.
Yes,
to your own satisfaction
yeah.
before you sign for it.
As I say, it could be a junior technician signing for doing the job, a corporal oversigning him, and then the corporal. Normally, the way these cards were made up, because it was a regular process. The independent check would be called for where they've had an engine completely apart and rebuilt. Then every control would have to be checked. So when he was given his job card, the last thing on that job card already stamped in was 100% independent control check to be carried out. And quite often, if there was no other senior NCO to do it, I would go and do that sort of thing. But most of my job was just general supervision and assessing what had to be done. When you get an engine in, you're provided with the log card for that engine. Now, some of these engines had been out in Germany for many, many months, and none of the routine mods had been done. So when you when it came in, you checked how many mods were outstanding, and during the servicing, which was probably for this foreign object damage or other serious problems, you would get all these mods done at the same time, because it was obviously the right way to do things. If you have it in bits, it was a case of just taking that bit and sending it back and putting a new bit on that was modified, and it cost you no man hours that way.
So you were doing general supervision, you were doing independent checks, and presumably the occasional bit of troubleshooting if anything out of the ordinary came up.
I mean, when the engines came to us, it might have engine caught fire, or engine oversped, or loud noise when such and such. Well, until you've got the thing taken down, you
can't work out what it is.
And the thing is that it might be the turbine end, or it might be the compressor end, or the front and the back. And by taking off the back end first and having a look at it, you'd say, ah, yes, I know what this problem is. And you can send the engine back to Rolls-Royce. It needs complete overhaul and whatever else needs to be done to it, because it's a major, a really serious major defect. But most of the engines we recovered, and it used to take between 7 and 10 working days from the time the engine entered the bay to being stripped right down to the last nut and bolt and rebuilt. 10 working days.
Did you have by that stage a sort of fairly standard routine working day and routine working week?
Oh yes, the bays very seldom did overtime, because they go in the morning at 8 o'clock, they'd get their overalls on, they'd start work. They were fortunate that they'd have a break at 10 o'clock for 15 minutes, back till 12 o'clock, and then home for lunch. Back at 1, 3 o'clock a break, home at 5. But it was regular working hours, and in some cases the reason the people were in the bay were because they had to be on regular working hours. People that were diabetics that had to have regular meals, couldn't miss a meal and so on. There were others there who had family problems that necessitated that they were at home in the evenings and so on. And so, as I say, a lot of them were hand-picked men, but they were assured of regular working hours. And
these were all servicemen?
Yes.
All your
staff, yes. And as I say, you used to try and vary the work a bit. If they'd been doing FOD damage, which is quite a problem, because you've got to remove all these broken blades or these damaged blades, and you've got to weigh them very, very accurately to a thousandth part of a gram, and then you've got to find a replacement blade that is within a weight range of the one you've removed. Now, on older engines where these blades have been worn, they're all fairly light, and all new blades are fairly heavy. And so to try and work out, you might be changing 30 blades, but to do it would probably take you almost a week to find blades and counterbalance them, and it gets a bit complicated.
Sounds like doing a jigsaw.
Well, yeah, and having had this sort of job, then you'd probably pick them off to do an easier, more routine job. Not necessarily any shorter in the hours required, but something that's fairly straightforward, that doesn't need all this mental sort of work. And of course, we were receiving new engines in from Rolls-Royce. We were receiving old engines back from Germany and the squadrons, 72 squadron as it was, and supplying built-up units, gearboxes, things like this that the squadron might need at a moment's notice. I mean, I was always on call, and it could be that at midnight there's a squadron in Germany that want a gearbox, and I've got the only one. Can I open up the bay and get it on route to the docks? And this would be catered for. But
did that happen often?
Not all that often, but I was called out to supply smaller parts to the squadron and things, which was usually just 10 minutes of your time, but they had to know that you were available. And then, of course, in winter, we were responsible for the snow blows. And although ODIUM is a helicopter unit, predominantly, we also had the Headquarters 38 group there, and we also had the odd fixed-wing aircraft that had to come in to do with 38 group or the Army Air Corps that were there. And so the runways had to be kept free of ice and snow. And using the old engines from the Meteor, the Derwents.
These are jet engines, aren't they,
yeah,
the Meteor?
They inclined them. They had two of them side by side, inclined on a big steel chassis with compressed where the tail pipes would usually be fairly round going out at the back. They made them into a vacuum cleaner suction hose,
yes.
You know.
So
and this blasted a wide area of the runway, and where you get sheet ice about an inch thick, using the snow blow, it gets underneath the ice and lifts it in great chunks, and they're really effective for sort of sorting out a runway. But it usually falls on the engine bay to maintain them and to train the operators who come from the squadrons, but you've got to show them how to start them and
use them.
And one of the problems was that in starting you can get what they call a wet start, where it doesn't ignite and you've got more fuel around the place than you know what to do with. And so whenever there was a call out for the snow blows, it was always in our interest to get down, get the snow blow out of the hangar, hang the bowser on the, because you put a bowser onto it, you see, it's like a snow plow, if you like. The bowser comes along and hooks onto it and hooks its fuel lines into the thing to keep it running. And then we used to get it started and hand it over to the lad who went out for 2 hours along the runway. And the one good thing was it had a good heater, because you had two gas turbines either side of your elbows.
As you were driving it.
As you were, well, you didn't drive it because it was pushed by a bowser, but you were operating the throttles and increasing the power if you needed to lift the ice a bit harder. But they could be good fun, but it was always in the middle of winter and miserable sort of weather. And it was during this time that we were doing quite a lot of good work and certainly saving the Air Force a lot of money. There'd been problems with Rolls-Royce in 1971, and there were various supply problems which I won't go into at this stage, but ODIUM really sort of had their act together, and they had some difficult jobs to do in Germany and so on, and to keep the supply of engines going was quite an achievement. So they decided that the job had become so involved that it deserved that the NCO in charge was no longer a chief tech but a flight sergeant, and my boss suggested that this was the way to get me promoted. So they changed the establishment from chief tech to flight sergeant, hoping to have me promoted. But of course there was a flight sergeant who had been held back because of a medical condition, who as soon as was made fit was to get the first post. And so I had a man posted into me,
senior
a chief tech like myself, but he'd been promoted. And I mean, he was senior to me, so there was no argument. but not as experienced on the particular job. Anyway, he took over, and he was a very, very nice fellow. I still correspond with him at Christmas. And he took over, and of course it took him some time to sort of get the routine, although he was purely administrative. Once he'd got the routine and wanted to sort of assume control, really it wasn't the place for me to stay.
And would you say then that once he knew how to do the job, you became in a sense redundant? Because
yes, within a way, because I was no longer responsible for the administration.
Yes.
And I was a misfit as regards the work, because yes. I was surplus to requirements. So there then came, they wanted, because the Whirlwinds were going out to the Far East, or the Wessex, sorry, they were going to move the Wessex out to the Far East to replace the Whirlwinds. They needed somebody who knew the engine bay procedure for the Wessex engines to go out and set up an engine bay in Hong Kong.
Where had you learned about that? Was that while you were at Odeon you'd learned about the Wessex engine?
Yes, oh yes, because when I'd gone away, the last time I was Whirlwind,
yes.
When I came back, it was the Wessex, and although I never worked on the Wessex as an aeroplane, I worked on the Wessex engines, which were very, very similar to the Whirlwind 10 engine. So they needed an engine bay that would go out to the Far East to support 28 Squadron, because it was on such a long leg away from normal supply routes.
Yes.
And also, it was very costly to send an engine back all the way to Rolls-Royce, which I think it cost something in the order of £75,000 to turn an engine round at Rolls-Royce. And if it was a minor problem, it would cost the Air Force an awful lot of money. Well, having watched the engine bay at Odeon develop over something like 15 years, until it was as efficient as we could make it, I was able to take all the files, all the list of spares holdings, and the toolkits. I mean, these toolkits, every job you needed to do on a Wessex engine during my time at Odeon, if the man had to get a tool that wasn't in his toolkit to do the job, I wanted to know about it. And so eventually we ended up with a toolkit where he didn't need to go anywhere to get a tool. Every tool that was needed for the stripping of a gnome was in the toolbox, or it was a special tool on a board that he could reach from his bay. And so, having achieved all this over the 15 years, and my predecessor before me had helped, and also the quantity of spares that should be held, and there were some peculiar sort of ones and two-offs and so on, I was able to get all this information, which I spent the last month at Odeon doing. I used a photocopier with acres of paper, which I got specially from Swanton Morley through a friend. And I was able to go out to the Far East. I was able to put in all the demands. I took a test bed out there with me for testing the engines, which had been refurbished having come back from the Middle East. We had our own test bed at Odeon, but this one was one that had been at Sharjah, a bit different to the Odeon one, but I took that out. And within 6 months of getting to Hong Kong, I had a fully operational reduced engine bay. It was only about a third of the size of Odeon, but it carried all the tools and spares for servicing the gnomes, and the balancing equipment for weighing blades and so on. And it was up and running. Well, they were trying to do the same thing in Singapore at the time, because there was an engine bay out there. I'm not quite sure when Singapore packed in, but the Singapore people used to have to bring their engines to Hong Kong to my bay to have them ground run in the test bed and to sort of, well, some of the servicing that they couldn't cope with. And so off I went to Hong Kong with my paperwork and all the know-how, and I set up the engine bay there, but I was there for 2 years.
Now, one thing occurs to me that when you're setting up a new facility like your engine bay in Hong Kong, you don't only need your own knowledge and all the tools and equipment, you also need the right personnel.
Oh, yes.
How did you manage to get hold of the right sort of people to operate the material you've got?
It was known as a key post, and they had to have somebody who was a specialised gnome engine deep servicing, if you like. We'd done special courses on this, so I had deep servicing experience on the gnome. There were two or three others also in Hong Kong that had done deep servicing.
Were they people you know? You knew?
Oh yes. We'd all been educated at Odeum.
On the same sort of courses.
We'd all been on the same squadrons. We'd worked on various bays and so on. Now, some of us had done the ordinary gnome course, which is given to all sort of squadron personnel, but others had been on the deep servicing course. Now, some had been on the courses and never done the job. And they'd probably done the course a year or two before. But when we got to Hong Kong, it was a 28 squadron, and these people had been operating the Whirlwind, but were now going to get the Wessex. Well, I'd been Whirlwind and Wessex anyway, right. And most of the people, some of them were from Shawbury, some of them were XSAR, some of them were Odeum. Others I'd met in on overseas tours in Singapore and so on. But we all more or less knew one another. Now, it didn't really matter that you'd had the deep servicing course. I was there. I had one young lad who I trained as a... We got what they call the Early Failure Detection Centre. And in its wisdom, the Air Force had put magnetic chip detectors all the way through the system of the transmission, from the tail gearbox through the main gearbox and the lower gearbox, etc. All had these magnetic plugs in, including the engine. And every so many hours, the plugs are removed, and any swarf that is on the magnet is transferred onto sellotape and put on a card. And this is then put under a microscope and also on a detector to detect whether it's ferrous or what you see.
What metal it is.
And all these are then sent back to Harefield House, which is the Early Failure Detection Centre in England. And they keep a check. And then if we got any serious problems, we would get in touch with Harefield and they would say, we know that it's the main bearing in the such and such that's failed, but more often than not, just by looking at the amount of metal, and also we're taking samples of oil, which they're doing a spectra oil analysis on, which is burning it, and they can tell by the spectrum how many parts are copper, how many parts are magnesium, how many parts are ferrous and so on. And it means that over the years that they've been doing this, they can almost tell if you've got a gearbox failure, as they did at Queen's Flight, had a main gearbox failure on a Wessex, they can tell exactly what has failed, why it's failed. And what's more, they can tell how many other aircraft are going to fail if they don't do something about it. So it is a useful diagnostic tool, as we call it.
It does sound rather like the mechanical equivalent of pathology.
Yeah, yeah, if you like. And they, it's quite a boring job, sort of getting a magnetic plug, washing it in white spirit and putting the bits off it onto a piece of sellotape, putting it on a card. And so the lower the rank that you can give this job, it gives him a feeling of importance that he is in charge of the Early Failure Detection Centre, and providing it's kept an eye on and you're getting it done and he's doing it nicely, And so I had one young man doing that for his entire tour. He was a married man, he didn't want any hassle, and he didn't want to be signing 700s and things, because that causes all sorts of problems if anything goes wrong.